This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Okay, well, thanks, Sina, and especially to Sina and to Cabinet for hosting this. I'm delighted that they let me do this. I still remember when I first discovered Cabinet magazine. Was one of those kind of emotionally torn moments when I was kind of furious that something this interesting existed without my input or permission. And I kind of would throw it across the room, and then I would just run back to it and keep reading, because if you don't know it, then subscribe immediately. I thanks just as much to Hugh, whose writing is equally stunning. If you haven't read In Amazonia or Insectopedia, then forget about this panel. Just go home now and read it. And he was also interviewed in Cabinet magazine about bees. So it's a little bit all in the family. And I should apologize to anyone who's come here to see Masha, because she couldn't make it, I'm afraid. So it's just us. But that's we can be nice and loose and open it up to you guys. I'm a little concerned that there's some actual anthropologists here who know what totems really are, but I'm just going to ignore that for now. Okay. And of course, thanks to you all for coming. I know the fierce attention economy of New York City, so I'm grateful that you're all here. But why don't we start with some bunnies. After all, that's why we're here.
Would you like the light to be lower,
Don? On the screen, you mean?
No, I mean...
Just in general?
Yeah.
A little bit, maybe? Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, that's good.
Little bunny foo-foo, hopping through the forest, scooping up the field mice and bopping them on the head. Down came the good fairy and she said, little bunny foo-foo, I don't want to see you, scooping up the field mice and bopping them on the head. I'll give you 3 chances, and if you don't behave, I'll turn you into a goon. The next day, little bunny foo-foo, hopping through the forest, scooping up the field mice and bopping them on the head. Down came the good fairy and she said, little bunny foo-foo, I don't want to see you, scooping up the field mice and bopping them on the head. I'll give you 2 more chances, and if you don't behave, I'll turn you into a goon. The next day, little bunny foo-foo, hopping through the forest, scooping up the field mice and bopping them on the head.
Don't behave, I'll turn you into a goon. The next day, little bunny
foo-foo, hopping through the forest, scooping up the field mice and bopping them on the head.
Down came the fairy and she said, little bunny foo-foo, I don't want to see you,
scooping up the field mice and bopping them on the head.
Behave?
Now you're a goon.
Okay. I can't leave that one up there, can I? It's too disconcerting. Okay, so they're all stolen off the web during Easter time. Why bunnies, though? Well, they loom very large, as you well know, in the popular imaginary. And for me, they form a special case. a quintessential totemic figure of this postmodern era, and a creatural figure which links what we might call the long 20th century from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, 1865, to The Matrix up to today. So we, like Alice and like Neo, follow the bunny down the rabbit hole into different spaces and disorienting, perplexing, challenging places. So I suggest that they're a virtual totem for psychic or cultural or philosophical uncertainty. So consider the prototypical magic act, making a rabbit appear out of a hat. This prestidigital standard has amazed and delighted children for many generations, since the hat seems to work as a kind of cosmic portal from which rabbits manifest themselves as if from nowhere. Thanks, Sina. As if they are a kind of tourist in our own dimension. There may or may not be a puff of smoke helping the bunny make the remarkable transition from not there to there, the Fort Dar game. A transition which subliminally initiates the children into the basic philosophical question, why is there something and not nothing? So in the first chapter, which I'm not going to talk about in much detail, but I chase many rabbit tails, arguing that the bunny is this totemic figure with all sorts of significant symbolic resonances and functions, including a starring role as a complex meta-decoy. You know, it's a kind of the idea of the parent or the doctor with the bunny puppet when you have to inoculate your child. You know, look at the bunny, stab, is the kind of paradigm that I start with. And relating it to media distraction and exquisite political manipulation. Donald Rumsfeld had the gall to say several years after the debacle in Iraq, quote, "There are an awful lot of people chasing the wrong rabbit here, it seems to me." Not for a moment considering himself as Elmer Fudd, looking for, you know, these Easter eggs of Easter eggs of mass destruction. So I draw this connecting line from the Pooka Harvey to the framed tune Roger Rabbit to the Lapin refugees in Watership Down to more abstract plot bunnies and Easter eggs up to Eduardo Cac's recent glow-in-the-dark bunnies of the biological kind. Okay, so for the next 15 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about totems, the totem redux, the totem in general, my conceited definition of it. And apologies to those who've heard this already, but I'm going to embellish after that. Okay, the totem is dead and buried, both as a way to help organize social cohesion for participants and as a model for the mapping of any given group for observers. After all, it has been over half a century since the doyen of structuralist anthropology, Claude Lévi-Strauss, delivered his influential funeral oration for the notion of the totem, what he called the phantasmagoria of the theorists. And yet the word keeps cropping up in popular consciousness, enjoying an ongoing afterlife as a fuzzy metaphor for certain types of extra-human symbols, affiliations, identifications, and behaviors. Indeed, the totem continues to serve all sorts of vague purposes beyond or outside the technical usage of social scientists or the indigenous peoples from whom the term was originally borrowed. The New Age fondness for personal animal spirit helpers, a popular poaching and personalization of clan-based totemic relationships, is only the most explicit instance of the ways in which the modern world continues to employ symbolic figures as virtual guides for actual situations. Nor is it necessary to wear an eagle feather in one's hair to be attuned to this kind of ubiquitous projection. The famous Contrada of Siena, for instance, continue to compete against each other in the manic horse race inside the city itself, bearing the heraldic emblems of their respective family trees, including caterpillars, owls, dragons, unicorns, towers, and seashells. Some may consider this merely a vestigial ritual, an echo of the medieval knights who once roamed the same territory with shields emblazoned with meaningful images. But we can also trace the impulse forward in time. Contemporary sports teams, for instance, not only have mascots dancing on the sidelines, but also the invisible and omnipresent totems which bear witness to the day's play, and whose capricious moods either make or break them during the game. hipsters, Hell's Angels, and bored suburbanites tattoo their bodies with images meaningful to their personal mythologies. Skulls, dragons, doves, lions, roses, fairies, rock stars, clowns, mothers, lovers, cartoon characters, onks, peace signs, mandalas, quills, teapots, barcodes, and so on. Pre-tween schoolgirls refuse to leave home unless at least one accessory or item of clothing is emblazoned with Hello Kitty. Whilst atheistic academics begin to irrationally sweat if they realize they have boarded a long-haul flight without their St. Christopher medal. That's where I cough guiltily. The totem is such a suggestive figure because it potentially includes all figures. Anything, that is, anything, is a totem waiting to happen, thanks to the idiosyncratic ways in which people psychologically and emotionally invest in objects, which, of course, can be a rather clinical word for other subjects. Now that the totem has become more personalized and liberated from the limitations of collective sense, it can be as varied as the contingency of any biography. The totem is an empty outline waiting to be shaped into something specific through subjective cathexis. This empty space is negatively charged. Its power comes from without. It is a fulcrum or quilting point around which things, events, convictions, desires, hunches, plea bargains, epiphanies, mistakes, and so on circle and gather. The child's teddy bear, for instance, is a proto-totem, an object of libidinal investment and proxy imaginings. The true totemic moment comes when the child identifies with, or at least obsesses over, an absent figure, such as a Pikachu or a Spider-Man. Here the break has been made between the fort of the concrete possession or companion and the da of virtual connection. The relatively stabilized narratives of selfhood, which constitute the healthy and normal adult, allow the totem to take a different kind of root in different psychic soil. The mature individual has learned to internalize and virtualize the teddy bear, giving it a far more complex, ambivalent, and symptomatic spin. We can function on our own in society as long as we know, on some level, that someone or something is looking out for us and has our welfare at heart. As a result, the fully totemized person is content, more or less, with the tote bag emblazoned with their badge of belonging, NPR, PBS, BBC, the so-and-so food co-op, etc., or alternatively, the bumper stickers and other paraphernalia that decorate one's motor vehicle. The Christian fish, the Confederate flag, the yellow ribbon, buxom mudflap silhouettes, truck nuts, etc. The totem is particularly seductive because, to gesture to Lacan, it emerges from the real, yet straddles the imaginary and the symbolic. All three bases are covered. The totem is thus a frequently traveled sky bridge between our daydreams and the external conditions and expectations which either limit or enable them to happen, of course, usually the former. To put it another way, if Deleuze is your cup of poison, the totem is the figure or refrain which crystallizes an assemblage over time. It is the desiring machine which allows intensities to mark out a familiar territory, all the while threatening or promising to form a line of flight into unknown landscapes. In the 1888 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, the celebrated mythographer and anthropologist J.G. Fraser wrote, quote, "A totem is a class of material objects which a savage regards with superstitious respect, believing that there exists between him and every member of the class an intimate and altogether special relation." End quote. We need only jettison the offensive word savage and replace it with person, and we have a perfectly serviceable definition for totems today. In contrast to Fraser's definition, however, the chapters in this book emphasize the virtual aspect of the material objects, often animals, but not at all, exclusively, which manifest the relationship. In other words, the focus is on the imaginative, abstract, metaphysical ways in which humans enlist non-humans to look after them, or indeed how humans feel they have been drafted by non-humans to be challenged, tested, or provoked. The New York Giants, for instance, can only have a virtual relationship with their team totem, unless we consider anyone above 7 foot a giant. The same applies for the New Jersey Devils. The Chicago Bears could feasibly point to an actual bear as a totem, but refrain to do so for practical and political reasons. In contrast, the Louisiana State University Tigers often bring a real live Bengal tiger named Mike to the stadium. But even as this animal fascinates by its exotic presence, it still merely represents, stands in for, the idealized avatar of tigerness, which the team hopes to channel in battle. If Mike dies, as he has, sadly, several times during the history of the team, the totem is still alive and well, don't worry, since it is always primarily a generic virtual figure. Even if we only consider faux tigers, the fuzzy suit of the mascot totem is the most important part and not the parade of different anonymous pelvic thrusting freshmen who inhabit it over the course of several decades. Once you start scanning the landscape for examples and relinquish the purest historical definitions bequeathed and later dismissed by anthropologists, totems begin to mushroom all over the place. Indeed, the vernacularization of the term has been going on for some time. Only 2 years after Fraser's 1888 entry in the Stately English Encyclopedia of Record, London's cheeky Pall Mall Gazette made special note of, quote, the vulgar embroidered smoking cap, which used to be the distinctive totem of the bizarre debauchee, end quote. It did not take long for the word to be employed outside the academy for any item with identificatory powers, in this case, a smoking cap. More than a century later, and the totem has continued to multiply and morph within public discourse. Consider how the figure of the grizzly mom, or tiger mom, has circulated in the lamestream media in the last few years, evoking a kind of spirit animal for certain ideologically charged demographic clusters. We could indeed add the notion of the cougar, a sexually aggressive older woman who is said to embody the highly coiled energies of a wild, predatory feline, an association with a long history extending through the various cat people of the noirish imagination, but with a new suburban twist. Sexy. So, despite the atavistic incense which clings to the word, the totem has insinuated itself into contemporary life as a way to understand certain charged objects or mediums, pointing to a quasi-religious surplus overflowing the prosaic or the banal, thereby helping to orient the individual in relation to the group and to help different subgroups orient themselves to the imagined whole. Marshall McLuhan, for instance, credited the seductive power of Hitler in terms of the tribal totem of the radio. Similarly, Roland Barthes unpacked his modern mythologies with the aid of this same principle, so that wine, for the French person, is nothing less than a totem drink, just as Charlie Chaplin projects a totem-like countenance. More recently, Judith Williamson describes our relationship to advertising as a kind of totemism, whereby carefully crafted semiotic solicitations encourage millions of consumers to step into what she calls the totemic space of essentially exchangeable products. Indeed, the list could go on. As a consequence, this figure suggests several elements simultaneously now that its tribal function has been diluted and diffused into the water table of postmodern experience. It plays a symbolic, ritualistic, virtual, and explanatory role for those who adopt it, or again, who feel adopted by it. For instance, in the example cited earlier, a grizzly mom looks to the female grizzly bear to explain her character. Fierce, loyal, brave, nurturing, protective, etc. As a consequence, Sarah Palin feels she has a more profound understanding of her own socially defined role as a working mother come public conservative political figure by reference to a creature that she has little, if any, actual contact with. She does not claim the title of Wolf Mom, since this would forbid her to indulge in one of her favorite sports, shooting wolves from a helicopter. The she-bear totem is thus a virtual presence in her own mind and life, floating free from an actual referent, which allows the ex-governor to make certain claims in regard to other groups, especially liberals, whose totem animal is presumably the yellow-bellied sapsucker. As one mid-century anthropologist observed, quote, totemic and other ritual symbols are the ideological landmarks that keep an individual on their course, end quote. And yet, while we look to the totem to help provide psychosocial coherence in a rather chaotic and contradictory world, we reduce it to certain desirable traits while eliminating others. For while Sarah Palin identifies with the power of a female grizzly bear, she would surely not want to be considered hairy or wild. Nor does she want to convey the message that she sleeps all winter and defecates in the woods. Although I'm sure she has camping, shooting. Today's totems are thus stylized and simplified symbols, which allow ideological messages to be delivered in shorthand, both to the self and to the other. So we can thus pull all these disparate elements together in order to redefine the totem in the following terms. A symbolic, virtual figure associated with a charged object or referent, which helps, or at least appears to, any given subject navigate unstable, ever-changing terrain as if it were stable. In the simplest language, a totem helps explain ourselves to ourselves in relation to others. It is alternately a guide, a guardian, a role model, a trickster figure, and a key to the cognitive map which has colonized the territory it was originally designed to represent. Few things, however, can truly and consistently deliver on such a promise, so totems are also ambivalent figures who can betray us, let us down, or lead us down the garden path. Okay, so Levi-Strauss once stated that animals are good to think with. And so it's my contention that totems, often in the form of animals, are similarly helpful in this respect, even if he has dismissed it as a concept. The term comes from an English fur trader, John Long, who returned to London in 1790 after spending 20 years amongst the indigenous nations in Canada. He actually fought American colonists alongside the Chippewa people. And he showed up in London in the port with a huge tattoo of a beaver on his chest. And when asked what it was, he said it was a totem. This is the OED's first recognition of this word, which translates from Ojibwe, is the language, I think. He is a relative of mine. So it's a filial thing. So totems are this wider, part of a wider social contract that we make with nature. So it's sort of Rousseau plus, where you expand the circle. Right? So, and the Wudjil people of Australia talk of it this way, where their totem is the crocodile, and they will point at a crocodile on a rock, and they'll say, that's our totem, and we have a deal with it. We won't eat it, and it won't eat us. It's just, that's, so it's the social contract that it extends beyond what we moderns might think of as the social. Of course, that line moves historically and geographically. So it's, to me, this illuminating index of the symbolic jostling which makes up our interactions of everyday life. So in Totem and Taboo, Freud claimed that in contrast to taboos like incest and murder, quote, totemism is something alien to our contemporary feelings, a religio-social institution which has long been abandoned as an actuality and replaced by newer forms. It has left only the slightest traces behind it in the religions, manners, and customs of the civilized people of today. So he's happy to say that there's still taboos. he wouldn't have been so famous without those, but that totems have fallen by the wayside. And yet, it's in his title. It's in his title, and it's in his practice, and it's in his work. Little Hans is a famous case of a boy who is terrified and fascinated by horses, and Freud explains this relationship explicitly as a totemic one. The horse is Little Hans's totemic animal, and of course he associates that with the father. No prizes for guessing the answers. And little Arpad, who also had a totemic identification with chickens, would even feed with them, I believe. So one of the aims of the book is to sort of question and test Freud's dismissal, considering the totem not so much in terms of irrelevance or atavism, but rather an ongoing mutation and a further virtualization within our constantly evolving socio-technical networks. And while I wrote that paragraph, it did make me wonder what Freud's totem would be if he did start seeing them in other people. I don't know. His pipe?
This is your bit.
Okay. His pipe, the couch. Any suggestions? I see people nodding. I don't know. The Sphinx, Oedipus itself, the phallus. Who knows? That's somebody's totem, I'm sure. You see it drawn enough, so it must be. Even the Martian rover has one. So it's, you know, I'm a media professor, so this is skewed very much to questions about contemporary media. I nearly did the anthropology, actually. I just thought I was going to be an anthropologist as an undergraduate, and then the course on kinship and alliance just killed me. It was just memorizing branching charts. I can't do it. It's too rigorous. It's too scientific. So I guess that's why it still haunts me. But if totems, even in tribal kind of contexts, are virtual, because, you know, it's not the crocodile on the rock, it's the crocodileness, that is an avatar. Once you render them in pixels, then it's a meta virtual totem. And in fact, it's W.J.T. Mitchell who's done the most to try and reinvigorate this concept. He's an art historian and media theorist, and his main question is, what do pictures want? He also says, what do totems want? And that's something else I try to answer. So totems are nothing if not tricksters. Moreover, the ones which keep circulating in the popular media are often as mute as they are insistent. This is not so much a return of the repressed as an ongoing and oblique hazing by the unheeded. So, and I also like just untimely concepts. So as Nietzsche knew well, it's often these creaky, arthritic, anachronistic ideas which are the most relevant and revealing just because they're so unfashionable. These untimely notions that they're like suddenly lucid grandparents that ironically allow a fresh perspective on an era which they themselves probably never expected to witness. So at that, I'd like to pass the mic to Hugh soon, but and invite about his reading or interpretation of the three T's. I gave his task really was to, we only had 24 hours to rethink our task when Masha dropped out because she was going to introduce us to her love dog, which is her new book. So dogs are gone, but stones. I think stones. Something around there. I won't pass it just yet.
I'll keep it turned off.
I'll turn mine off when you okay. So are you still talking about standing stones?
Yes.
Yes. And according to Mitchell, in fact, they have a special, stones have a special totemic significance, especially fossils and other culturally marked stones. For him, they crystallize something individual into a kind of concrete universal. And he has this sort of historical schematic where in the ancient and classical period we had idolatry, in early modern we moved to fetishism, and it is actually for him the modern and postmodern era that is totemistic. So he turns it around. It's not something old-fashioned that we should let go, but it's only in the modern era that totemism really hits home. But before that, I would just like to show a very short film by Merritt Simes, who's sitting up the back, which features ravens, which is one of her totems, for their dark and flocking intelligence. Does anyone know the collective noun for a raven? You must know crows, the famous murder of crows. But ravens apparently are different. I always thought they were the same. But ravens have their own collective noun because they're their own creature. And they're an unkindness. An unkindness of ravens. So don't expect any sympathy when you're crying in a field. But these images of this short film of Merritt's have been poached from one of the most rare and expensive photography books of the 1980s called The Solitude of Ravens. Probably somebody here maybe has a copy, by Masahisa Fukase. Does anyone know his story? It's a little sad. His marriage broke up partly due to his alcoholism, and he then spent his time haunting the streets and surrounds of Hokkaido, taking photos of ravens, until he fell down some stairs and into a coma in 1992. He was in that coma until just last year when he died. So there was 20 years of coma. And in a sense, to me, Merritt's film, she has her own interpretation. But for me, this must be kind of the images that were fluttering around his mind for those 20 years, which may have felt like 2 minutes or 2,000 years. On that somber note, I'll hand it over to Hugh. And
does that work? Okay, so you can hear that? Great. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay, good, thank you.
Mine's almost 8 years old.
Okay, mine's. Well, I think I'm here as the totemic anthropologist, but actually, I don't know when you learned anthropology, but I knew nothing about totems. I barely knew what the word meant till I read your book. But I was glad you mentioned the Ojibwe. So this is going to be an anthropological moment. Because I'm going to talk about stones, and there's a very famous story by an anthropologist in the 1960s called, Hallowell, but I don't remember what his first name is, who worked with the Ojibwe. And he tells this story of how he asked somebody, he'd been doing all these things about, about objects and animism and things being alive. And he said to people, so are your stones alive? And the reply he got was, well, some of them are. And it's very famous, mostly because, because it's interesting. Okay, so we're here to celebrate Dom's book and look at the bunny, and I feel very good about that, even though it means I can't ever publish a book with the title Bunny in the word bunny in the title. But it's okay. We talked quite a lot about this book over the last couple of years, and I read it, and I recommend it to you. And when he invited me to join the event, I said yes, that I would like to do that. And then I tried to think about what I would do after having said yes. And, the three key words on the book after bunny were totem, taboo, and technology. And I didn't know much about totems or taboos, and I knew a little bit about technology. So I thought about it and thought about it, and I went back over the material that I had for stones that I've been working on for the last couple of years, and I found a stone that I thought I could write, talk about, and then Masha pulled out, and that was sort of perfect for me, actually. Not for anybody else, but for me it's perfect because the story was too long, but now I've got all the time in the world to tell you this really, really long story. Yep. So, that's what you're going to get. So this is about a famous stone known as the Odin Stone that lived on Orkney of Scotland. And it is sort of, in retrospect, after I'd done it, when I try to fit it in context, it's a little bit totemic. And it has a couple of taboo moments, and it's definitely a technology. And we'll see. Anyway, I'll start with a few minutes of high culture to set a tone that's becoming to the event. But that will pass quite quickly, and then we'll move on to the story. Yes, okay. Okay, good. Okay. This is Anselm Kiefer. So you're going to get high culture. This is Anselm Kiefer struggling to capture Wagner's most totemic stone, the rock on which that most important of the ancient German Scandinavian gods, ragged, riven, unyielding Wotan, known to the Norse as Odin, abandons Brunhilde, his devoted Valkyrie daughter, conceding only to surround her with the towering flames that Siegfried, who neither knows nor shows fear, will one day penetrate. Wagner's ring is peopled by heroes, gods, and giants. It is, wrote Theodor Adorno, secular and magical at one and the same time. Adorno didn't intend that as a compliment. His mother was an opera singer, and the philosopher himself was a gifted musician. But his essay on Wagner, written in 1937, turned to this most ambitious work of 19th century European high culture to excavate the origins of fascism. In The Ring, he wrote, the true idea of opera, that of consolation, which once forced the very gates of Hades to open, has now been lost. Wagner might have aimed to shatter bourgeois aesthetics with his total artwork, his art of the future, but all he succeeded in creating, Adorno said, was a nightmarish regression into an archaic past, a descent that at the very moment that Adorno was writing seemed to be reaching its fulfillment with the Nazis. The Ring's mythic universe acknowledges neither history nor the supernatural nor even the natural, wrote Adorno. It lies beyond all such categories. Wagner's gods are all too human. Brunhilde's rock is primal, elemental, and incontrovertible. The dramas are neither transcendental nor factual. Immersed in myth, they play out, he writes, with a geological flourish, on a stratum of subject matter where all is undifferentiated. A world beyond time that makes a dream time of the present. It's kind of jarring how he reduces the ring to ideology, as if its effects were really so fixed, as if the present through which it resounds were always somehow suspended outside history. But it's kind of obvious, too, why, writing from exile in London and New York in those days, he was compelled to account for the ease with which Wagner's work was assimilated to National Socialist visions of folkish destiny and the eternal right. Even before the first curtain is raised, Wotan Odin sets the world awry. He plucks out his eye in a bargain for wisdom. He mutilates the world ash tree for the spear shaft in which to carve his law. He cuts destiny adrift. These are the foundational stories that fix him to knowledge, war, and death. He's a sorcerer, his single eye the sign of his visionary power. He turns warriors into invulnerable and terrifying berserkers, or he lets them think he has, and he watches as they careen to destruction. And this is Brunhilde's rock, encircled by mystic fire, witness to impossible deeds and strange revelations. It is, to use the term coined by the famous scholar of religion and erstwhile fascist, Mircea Eliade, a hierophany, a thing that gives access to that time, illud tempus, the non-historical time of the sacred, that time, mythic time, deep time. Most of us, most of the time, live in historical time.
Nothing came up?
No.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, nothing. Nothing came up. Oh. No. It's choreographed. No. Most of us, most of the time, live in historical time, a time filled with unique events that once done are done for good, never to return. Maybe, though, if or when we're more religious or spiritual or mystical or committed to particular origin stories or to some other version of an enchanted world, then sometimes, on some days or in some ways, or for some of us on all days and in all ways, we might inhabit mythic time, the time in which archetypal originary events took place, events which ever since that originary beginning are being unceasingly repeated, again and again revealed in revelatory technologies, revelatory totemic technologies, like bunnies, actually, no, like stones. Sharon and I are on our way to Britain's far north. We take the train from King's Cross to Glasgow, check into a shiny new hotel near the station, and walk along the Clyde Requiem to shipbuilding. It's June, 11 p.m., and it's not getting dark. A bright yellow car whips around a bend, two guys up front, stereo blasting. They slam to a halt outside a pub, and one jumps out and starts this like crazy come-and-get-me dancing for these three women who are standing by the curb holding drinks. He's funny, they're funny back. It's Saturday night, and it's in Glasgow, and as anybody who's been there knows, everybody is a comedian. Next morning, we rent a car, a red one, and we start driving. At Scrabster, where the road runs out, we buy ready-sorted crisps and tickets for the nine-mile ferry ride to Orkney, and sit on a wall on the tiny harbour, legs dangling, kicking our heels against the peeling paint, and watching the big trucks roll in with supplies for the islands. We set sail with barely a breeze, and the air is clear, the sky is sky blue. But halfway out, the boat slides into fog, and the temperature plummets. It's impossible to see past the gunwales. The foghorn blows. Everyone retreats below. In the lounge, they're pouring whiskey and frying up fish and chips with mushy peas. Few people look queasy. And back on the rear deck, the fog clears as abruptly as it came, and there across the waves, it's land. The captain announces the old man of Hoy, all 449 feet of him, a pillar of striated red sandstone capped with green grass. We all crowd the railing, Atlantic wind in our hair, salty spray on our faces, jokes cracking, cameras whirring, to see the soaring sea stacks sail by. Someone says, it's calm enough now, but the winter water's wild. That old man looks solid, but it won't be here forever. We ease onto the quay at Stromness and follow the directions in Aubrey Beall's Guide to the Stone Circles of Britain, Ireland, and Brittany. Beall is a friendly and knowledgeable companion. The Orkneys, he tells us, are megalithic oddities. Narrow roads, low hedges, gentle hills, scudding clouds, ocean horizons, heather and peat, greens, greys, browns. We drive north to the Loch of Harry. For close to 5,000 years until Christmas Day, 1814, a tall slab of sandstone stood here that at some point became known as the Odin Stone. The Odin Stone is part of the monument complex that now forms the heart of Neolithic Orkney, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Centered on the Ness of Brodgar promontory, which ties together this spectacular circle called the Ring of Brodgar and a Neolithic settlement called Barnhouse Settlement, it includes the Great Passage Grave of Maes Howe and the remains of a Neolithic village of Scarrow Brae. It's an unparalleled concentration of Neolithic constructions that's only increasing in importance as the excavations continue. We need to turn the map of Britain upside down when we consider the Neolithic, says Nick Card, who directs archaeological research here. London may be the cultural hub of Britain today, but 5,000 years ago, Orkney was the center for innovation in the British Isles. Sketches by the few 18th century antiquarians to brave the crossing from Scotland show the Odin Stone as 8 foot tall and elegantly tapered, similar to the other standing stones here, although wider, shorter, and with an oval hole punched through it about a third of the way up and off to one side. That hole was unusual, but it wasn't unique, even in Orkney. On North Ronaldsay, say the most outlying of the islands, there's a similar punctured stone. Amir Chaliada, always eager to find matching beliefs in widely dispersed times and places, describes newborn babies being passed through such openings in both ancient India and modern Europe. In his view, these stones represent a sun, a divine womb, or a yoni, a vagina, and traveling through them, he says, implied a regeneration by means of the feminine cosmic principle. You can take that or leave it. Testimony from Orkney suggests that encounters with the Odin Stone took place in a less esoteric idiom, but that it too gave Orcadians access to an expanded universe. The stone's presence brought supernatural possibility to everyday life, a bulwark against the modern distinction between myth and history, and the unremittingly chronological version of time that goes with it. Stories collected in the mid-20th century by the Orkney writer and folklorist Ernest Marwick show that people relied on the Odin Stone to prevent and cure ailments, and that it was where lovers, most famously the Stromness pirate, John Gow, swore the binding oath of Odin, sometimes exchanging the halves of a broken sixpence through the hole. Gow, who was immortalised by Daniel Defoe and Walter Scott, left off marauding the Iberian Peninsula in 1725, and he refitted in mainland Orkney. And there, passing as a merchant captain, he fell into a romantic swirl with a woman called Helen Gordon, also from Stromness. They committed to each other in the local way by hand-fasting through the Odin Stone, but then Gow was captured and exposed. Gordon trailed him down to London, set on revoking her vow. Arriving after the hanging, she went directly to Execution Dock, and she waited on the riverside stairs for the low tide. A resourceful Orkney woman, she grasped Gow's cold hand as it surfaced and declared her independence. Then she set off on the long and arduous journey home. Gow, like many captured pirates of the post-Golden Age, made a prolonged and grisly exit, tarred and slowly decomposing in a gibbet overlooking the Thames at Greenwich. The 19th century Orkney antiquarian, Walter Trout Denison, collected a more Wagnerian narrative, a dimmed and blurred memorial, he says, of the subduing of the last of the Orkney Picts by the conquering Norse, a mythical history of how a remnant of the conquered race was extirpated. History, I imagine, that dates back to the 8th century Viking incursions here and the rule of the Norwegian Jarls from 875 to 1231. This is the story of Thorodale, the Orkney hero, who avenged the kidnapping of his young wife by winning Holy Island from the amphibian Finnfolk sorcerers for whom it was Hildeland, the hidden land, their magically invisible above water summer home. For 9 moons at midnight, when the moon was full, Denison recounts, Thorodale went 9 times on his bare knees, around the Elden Stone of Stenness. And for 9 moons at full moon, he looked through the hole in the Elden Stone and wished he might gain the power of seeing Hildeland. When the Enchanted Island finally appears, Thorindel and his 3 sons row very determinedly through thrashing whales, naked mermaids, and fire-spitting monsters to reach its shore. And there he counters Finfolk's sorcery with more of his own, cutting 9 crosses in the ground and circling the perimeter with 9 rings of salt. So 9 was obviously a supernatural number. It was the number of worlds over which the immeasurable immensity of the world Ashtree extended, and it was Odin's number, the number of days during which, impaled by his spear, the fractured god hung upside down from the tree on his quest to gain the wisdom of the runes, the sacred runes carved on the sacred tree that was fatally cut. The sacred runes carved on the sacred spear that was fatally cut from the sacred tree before the curtains even risen on the first act of the ring. So, Neolithic standing stones challenge archaeological interpretation, admit the archaeologists Adrian Challens, Mark Edmonds, and Colin Richards. As single or paired examples, they write, they rest in isolated, unfathomable splendor. Standing stones invite speculation. They demand it even. But where do you begin? As they pull us deeper and deeper into deep time, familiar evidence melts away. Written, then oral histories evaporate. Myths and legends disappear. Archaeologists deploy speculative reason, inductive method, and flights of archaeo poetry to travel with stone. They reconstruct stone life from ambiguous signs in the landscape, a notch in a hill, a beckoning constellation, a midwinter sunrise, a sight line between sights, a ditch that repeatedly waterlogs. And also from the more or less expressive outcomes of walking, digging, sifting, and measuring. This kind of evidence is everywhere, bringing life to and from the stone, which itself is a higher and more abstract order of evidence. Colin Richards, who led excavations at the nearby Barnhouse settlement, suggests that stone monuments may be expressions of ancestor worship, and that despite their symmetrical magnificence, the completed forms might not be the point. Instead, a circle or row may have grown piecemeal. The stones were raised on separate occasions to honor individuals and demonstrate the power of a family or clan. An Orkney standing stone, he adds, may be reaching up to the sky and to whatever is important there. It may be mirroring the surrounding hills that dominate its valley. It may be echoing sea stacks like the Old Man of Hoy. This is expert speculation. It draws on anthropological accounts of modern megalithic stone raising in other parts of the world. Kind of a risk given what history can do to descent, as well as on the material products of transect, stratigraphy, chemical assays, cartography, and electrical resistance surveys. Unlike the wood that often predated it in wood henges and timber circles, stone persists, perhaps for eternity, requiring only to be animated. The frustration is that its animation, which is ultimately simply the rediscovery of the animating principles of its time, relies on the conceptual repertoire of our time. Concepts such as symbolism, mimesis, process, and phenomenology. Concepts too distant, as well as too disenchanted for the task. This is the alluring gap that stone opens, evidences, but refuses to fill. The gap of which that long-lost gap, 1/3 of the way up the Odin stone, the gateway to an expanded universe, is somehow totemic. The gap that summons archaeopoetics from archaeologists, just as it summons geopoetics from geologists and poetic poetics from poets. Poetic flights that try to apprehend life from stone, gathering up the millennia in the effort to know. That was deliberate to you. Yeah. You get the idea. It's no, exactly. You know. So back, further back past the English, back past the Scots, back past the Norwegians, past the Vikings, past the Picts, past the Iron Age Brock builders, past the Bronze Age barrow builders, past the Neolithic with its stone circles, its cairns, and its passage graves, past the Mesolithic with its hunter-gathering bands, gingerly feeling their way around the unpeopled islands. Back through ever-expanding and still accelerating time. Back beyond our quaternary with its ice ages and modern humans, back beyond the neogene with its hominids slipping down from the trees, back beyond the paleogene with its first primates and whales, back beyond the Cretaceous with its flowering plants and extinction of the dinosaurs, back beyond the Jurassic with its long-necked sauropods, its supersized crocodiles, its sharks, ferns, and birds, back beyond the Triassic with its corals, its small mammals, and the splitting of Pangaea, back beyond the Permian, Pangaea's birth, and the largest mass extinction yet known, back beyond the Carboniferous with its coal-bearing forests, its reptiles, and its amniotic eggs, back more than 400 million years, back all the way to the Devonian period with its dry forests, its giant armor-plated fishes, and its pioneer amphibians and arthropods, taking their first awkward steps out of water toward the uncertain promise of muddy land. Around 390 million years ago, sometime during the Aephelian or Gavetian subdivisions of the Middle Devonian, the Iapetus Ocean shriveled to a skinny diagonal streak above the parking lot at Neapel in the Isle of Man. And as the dust cleared on the Caledonian orogeny, Orkney lay about 10 degrees south of the equator, an arid desert on the supercontinent Euro-America, unstable progeny of the explosive union between Laurentia, Baltica, and romantic-sounding Avalonia. Vascular plants had reached dry land, and vertebrates had followed. And soon, vertebrates would clamber up behind them, beside them, suck air into lungs, and some of them would take to the sky. Adrift at the dawn of the Permian, Euro-America joined the other land masses in bonding with the world continent Pangaea. 100 million years later, during the Jurassic, it cut loose with its dinosaurs, ammonites, sharks, rays, ferns, ginkgos, and conifers, and took off with Laurasia, the northern supercontinent. When Laurasia fell apart during the Cretaceous, Euro-America did too. What was once Laurentia headed out to North America. What had been Baltica took its chances with Eurasia. Avalonia, caught in the middle, tore itself in two. Euro-America was the old red sandstone continent, named for its thick deposits of sandstone sediment, weathered under semi-arid conditions from the continent-wide chain of the Caledonian Mountains. Old red sandstone is the name for all this Devonian rock, even though much of it is far from red. In Orkney, it's the bedrock for almost the entirety of the islands, and most of it is blue-gray, deposited, cemented, compacted, and laminated in Lake Orcady, a shallow freshwater lake bustling with early life that for centuries filled the considerable expanse of the Orcadian Basin, a depression which stretched from the Moray Firth up and out all the way to the Shetlands. 5,000 years ago, only 5,000 years ago, Orkney stonemasons were developing a taste for elegant blue-gray Stromness flagstones. A species of that old red sandstone formed in Lake Orcady some 390 million years earlier. They cut many of the standing stones at the Ness of Brodka from these flags, and they probably cut the Odin stone from them too. Imagining these stone cutters crossing the windswept hills to the hilltop quarry of Vestra Field, 6 miles away, collecting and sizing their slabs and hauling them down to the promontory, it makes me wonder about that alluring gap which stone opens, a window in time of which this long-lost hole, one-third of the way up, the Odin stone is somehow totemic. It's foolish to imagine that we share the same ideas of beauty across the centuries, let alone the millennia. It's foolish to imagine we can truly access those ancient sensations. But it's also certain that this layered sandstone makes beautiful and impressive objects. And it's clear that something here resonates somehow, in some way, no doubt now in an entirely 21st century media-mediated, historically overdetermined way, but there's not really any way around it. When we visit Orkney, we too feel the stone. December 25th, 1814, and Christmas dinner at the Orkney home of Malcolm Lang, the author of a 4-volume history of Scotland, a friend of the radical Whig statesman Charles James Scott Fox, and until 2 years earlier the Member of Parliament for Orkney and Shetland, is interrupted by word that Captain W. Mackay, a newly arrived tenant farmer from Caithness, is dynamiting the stones of Stenness. It was too late for the Odin stone. Along with one of the tall flags in the Stenness circle, it was already shivered to pieces. A third stone was toppled but not broken. Mackay was acting as a modern farmer. Lang responded as a modern antiquarian. The attack on the stones was an injury, he wrote, to the community at large, which has no interest in the preservation of public monuments, not to mention to men of letters and curiosity throughout the kingdom. There was often a taboo against disturbing ancient stones and a corresponding price to pay. A tornado hit a tomb robber's house on Arran. A mysterious explosion destroyed the home of a parson who tampered with a cist in Devon. Unexplained illnesses and deaths befell the disrespectful and their families in Oxfordshire, Montgomeryshire, and the Isle of Man. Sudden sicknesses of animals afflicted farms in Aberdeen, Banff, and Cornwall. Terrifying thunderstorms followed assaults on stones in Berkshire, Cumbria, and Merion Eath. Sometimes cattle or horses refused to cross the threshold of byres built or repaired with plundered stones. Sometimes the animals wandered off through a stone barn door that refused to stay shut. Sometimes the animals simply stopped working. The Bale Gregan standing stone in Argyll leaned over a grave robber, scaring him away. The grey stone of Corticrum in Aberdeen crushed to death the man digging at its base. So did the Carrig Fearden stone in Carmarthenshire in South Wales. Perhaps Mackay hadn't heard these stories. More likely, he had little patience for country tales in an age when practical science was remaking the physical, economic, and moral landscape. He later said he was fed up of people trampling his pasture to visit the circle. He said he wanted the stone to build a byre. Yet the subtenant cotters, displaced to accommodate Mackay's arrival, were already ill-disposed towards him. The loss of the stones intensified their dislike of this interloping Scottish ferry looper, as well as their anxieties about the impact of agricultural improvement, enclosure, and the loss of local life and its traditions, including those attached to the Odin stone. News of the clearances and the relentless assault on the Highland clans spread through the Orkneys since the 1790s. Large-scale change arrived relatively late, but when it did, it was transformative. Over the next 50 years, almost the entire 45% of Orkney held as common land would disappear, and with it all protections for the customary grazing rights of tenants and cotters. It was, in fact, Mackay's laird, Lord Armadale, who took the initial step, undertaking the first division of the Orkney Commons in the parish of Stenness, a long process that was reaching completion just as Mackay turned his own attention to the stones. Stenness cotters responded to the new insecurities, as did agricultural-dependent people throughout Britain. They tried to force the improvers off the land with threats of conspiracy and arson. Twice, Mackay survived attempts to burn down his farm. It seemed there was a price to pay for the destruction of the Odin stone. Captain Mackay, wrote the local sheriff, has indeed suffered a sort of mean persecution. The Orkney stones weren't alone in their vulnerability. All across the British Isles, ancient monuments faced similar trials. Many disappeared completely, others survived only in reduced form. The most assaulted of all was also the largest and most impressive, the spectacular complex of rings, megaliths, and earthworks surrounding the village of Avebury in Wiltshire, where from about 1320 until a final dynamiting in 1829, close to 600 stones were buried, burned, or broken, and perhaps now there's about 150 left. The location of others is marked by bleak concrete pyramids that stand, as Aubrey Beau put it, like Passchendaele memorials. In January 1649, John Aubrey, best known now for Brief Lives, which is a collection of these very sort of tart, elegant biographical sketches, took a break from hunting with royalist friends and rode into Avebury village. He found himself unexpectedly surrounded by dozens of giant Saracen stones. He recognized their significance right away, even though the scale and unity of the site was camouflaged by fields, hedges, trees, and the bustling village that sprawled from its center. Aubrey had been touring Britain, documenting remains. He was among the first to conclude that the mysterious stones he encountered predated the Romans, and that there were deeper and more mythic histories of Britain to be written. His task, he said, was that of a scribe, to make the stones give evidence for themselves. The Saracens in Avebury, and also the Saracens at Stonehenge, were remnants of sandstone deposits that formed in the warm sea that covered the Marlborough Downs 50 million years ago, during the Eocene. They were hard blocks weathered from a sandstone cap that eventually formed a silicate crust in the wet and warm tropical climate. These giant slabs that washed down into the Wiltshire valleys as the chalk that underlay them softened in the enduring wetness of the last ice age, until about 4,300 years ago, the Neolithic masons of Avebury and Stonehenge must have encountered them too, and began an extractive industry that persisted for millennia and left only tiny pockets of these Cenozoic rivers of stone, tiny pockets that you can still see in the National Nature Reserve at Fifield Down and one or two other nearby places. Aubrey mapped and described the stones at Avebury in considerable, if not always precise, detail. But the eclectic Monumenta Britannica that contained his findings circulated only as notes among friends and colleagues, remaining an unpublished and disorderly manuscript for nearly 350 years. As a result, when the 31-year-old William Stukeley arrived at Avebury in March 1719, he could stake claim as the discovery of a wonder that, in Aubrey's unread words, did as much excel Stonehenge as a cathedral does a parish church. The stones at Avebury were destroyed in many ways. A large number were victims of opportunistic or utilitarian felling to clear a path, a carriageway, or a field, a similar motivation to that which had apparently driven Mackay to attack the Odin Stone. Both Aubrey and Stukeley describe this fire and water method, in which stones were toppled into a pit packed with burning hay, and a line of water poured over the heated stone, which was then hit on that line with a sledgehammer. This is Stukeley's drawing, and he described the burnings as an auto da fe. And they may have served some of the same exemplary purpose, because their inefficiencies in cost and labor could be compensated by the symbolic spectacle of the smoke and flames. Less well known, though, is the large-scale burial of stones, a peculiar labor-intensive practice almost unique to Avebury that seems to have begun in the late medieval period and continued for at least six centuries. Stone burial has been conventionally interpreted as an ambivalent solution to pressures from the church to eradicate the visible signs of paganism. In Aubrey Beall's words, assuming the continued influence of the edict issued by the Council of Nantes in 896 that forbade the worship of stones, this was doing God's work without upsetting the devil. But recently, the archaeologists Mark Gillings and Joshua Pollard have made the interesting suggestion that these were actually not burials but replantings of stones that local people believed grew out of the ground. As such, what appears to be a burial was simply the right way to remove a standing stone, whether for utilitarian, opportunistic, or religious reasons. So, I've gone on a long time, but I'm just about done, but not quite. Because the story sort of has an ending. According to Ernest Marwick, the Orkney folklorist, a piece of the Odin stone about 5 feet long and 2 feet wide, the piece as it happened that contained the hole, survived the dynamiting. That piece of stone was sunk into the ground on Mackay's farm and used as the central axis of a horse mill. When the horse mill was replaced by a water mill sometime around 1895, the entire rig, including the stone, was sold to a neighboring farm. In the 1940s, water mills were superseded by oil-fired threshing mills. The surviving piece of the Odin stone was pulled up and dumped in a corner of the farmyard. One day, writes Marwick, who visited the farm in the 1960s and talked to everyone involved, one day, when the owner of the farm was away from home, his son decided to tidy away the scrap machinery. He found the stone impossible to move. Knowing nothing of its history, he took a large hammer and he broke it into tiny pieces. Only when his father returned and exclaimed angrily, "You had no damn business breaking that stone. That was the stone of Odin." Only then, writes Marek, did he realize what the discarded stone had actually been. And such, then, all too often, is the fate of totems, taboos, technologies, and forgotten stones, and bunnies. And that's it, and kidney stones. Thank you. Yeah. yes.
There's one, I have one more page. One more page and then a 4 minute film. I'm delighted to have that preview of Hugh's book on stones, which he's in the midst of, and whatever the
buried under.
Whatever the equivalent of the Blarney Stone is for literature, it's something he's been French kissing for a long time. But geopoetics, my conclusion does try to get a little poetic, I must confess. And Merritt was good enough to render a filmic version, and it does have this same kind of anthro-decentrist time scales to it. So hopefully that will go quite smoothly. So, yes. I'm not going to read it all, but I'm just going to give you two paragraphs to give you to set up the film. And the conclusion's called Zigzag, the Totem of Movement. Lightning, snake, human. Lights, camera, action. Between the primeval animal shadows that once twitched on cave walls and the animated creatures writhing on our cinema screens today, we reconstruct a series of jump cuts connecting them. Assembled in the editing room of history by chain-smoking and watery-eyed theorists of the image, this looped, stuttering montage depends on an essential abstract totemic figure, the zigzag, since all movement zigzags, no matter how linear it appears to our oversimplified sensorium. This graphic symbol mimics movement itself, wrenched outside of time, outside the temporal flow, quote, not a concatenation but a shock between elements. In other words, before any given virtual entity or virtual object, we have virtuality itself, the zigzag, the maybe this, maybe that, the only traceable after the fact. What's more, this sign of totemic potency and potential has, over the centuries, morphed its way around the world, smuggled inside the Trojan horse of eternally new media. Beware of geeks bearing gifts. For the Soviet film director, Sergei Eisenstein, the famous sculpture of the, now am I pronouncing it right, any art historians, the Laocoon? Sounds like Lacan, right? Is Western culture's totem of movement. This is due to the fact that it is an image produced by montage, despite also being a static piece of marble. So this is maybe another link, is that so for Eisenstein, the Laocoon is the totem of movement, even though it's a frozen still in marble. Laocoon himself, the subject of the sculpture, was a Trojan priest who warned against accepting the suspicious equine present from the city's enemies. A deadly fraud is this. Rather than be rewarded for his prescience, however, Laocoon was instead subsequently condemned to death for presuming to make love to his wife in the presence of a divine image. An offense compounded by his fathering two children, despite his religious vocation. In the Vatican today, one can see the Marmolian reconstruction of this dynamic sculpture, originally created by a trio of ancient sculptors from Rhodes around 200 BC. This depicts Laocoon and his unfortunate sons surrounded by killer snakes entwined around his arms and legs, a disturbing tableau of frozen movement and horror. I do have it here for those who can't remember. A disturbing tableau of frozen movement and horror, an arrested line of fright, snakes on a Deleuzian plane. The cinema, that's what I do, all right? I do bad jokes. Everyone knows by now I do bad jokes. Too many zingers was what the dean said to me the other day. I just had a review. Too many zingers. The cinema, or new media in general, does not supersede the totem, but allows a different environment for it to breed. And so I'd just like to finish with Merritt's short film based on this conclusion. No. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me more. It was working before.
DLC,
Yeah.
Oh, try VLC. Good old, what would we do without VLC? Okay, great. Maybe the lights, this is a good one, dark. Thanks. She's very shy. Possible to turn up or the sound? Oh, it's me. Oh, why is it going up? Sorry.
Ce que vous inventez, ce n'est pas des concepts, ce n'est pas votre affaire. Ce que vous inventez, c'est ce qu'on pourrait appeler des blocs de mouvement duré. Si on fabrique un bloc de mouvement duré, peut-être que c'est qu'on fait du cinéma.
Абстрактно мыслить не умеете.
Уж не собираетесь ли вы учить меня смыслу жизни?
Garder le mystère, nous vivons dans le mystère, il faut que ce mystère soit sur l'écran. C'est aussi, au hasard Balthazar, deux lignes qui se rencontrent, qui sont parallèles à certains moments et puis au contraire qui se traversent.
Здесь все кем-то выдумано. Здесь это чья-то идиотская выдумка. Неужели вы не чувствуете? А вам, конечно, до зарезу нужно знать. Shandim me.